I'm trying to make up my mind whether I feel like a corpse. And I should now say that the body will be carried out through that door. Or whether I feel like some damn sideshow exhibit. At any rate, you really heard the speech of the evening. My comments are going to be briefer. I don't mean to be at all ungrateful. I appreciate what you've said, and it gets me very skitsy when you sort of wonder who these things are all being said about. And at times I find myself looking around to see, you know, who it is. Some of your historical materials, or background materials, are not quite so. My first contact with what I felt was with social protest was in organizing students as a freshman against compulsory chapel at the University of Chicago. And winning that one. And my experience in going around or in just plain living creates a state of real confusion, because when you talk about crime and you talk about the Capone gang, I'm not sure who you're talking about. Because, believe me, from my own experience, I found a much higher standard of morality and of honesty and integrity and commitment to some of our basic human values in the Capone Syndicate than I found in a great number of religious denominations. And certainly very little hypocrisy of the kind that is prevalent in our society. I give this as a word of defense in terms of the Capone gang. And I never did take any tidbits from any cafeteria. I never took any tidbits from anybody, nor any charity. And if you remember the sources from which you're referring to, while it seemed to have been an organized racket that was set up to get food, it was done with good, dignified dishonesty. But with dignity on it, you know, no charity. What I would like to talk to you about tonight, and very briefly, because I believe the main meat of what will go on here between my colleagues and myself and between you. I've always found that there was infinitely more communication when we were dealing in the area of specifics rather than of generals. And those specifics that you were particularly concerned with. If from time to time a question comes up which requires a little more detailed exposition, why, I may go into it for 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, so that actually what this will break down to will be a whole series of short statements rather than a formal presentation. Now, any one of the things that has been suggested for discussion would be a full presentation by itself. For example, what is the role of the church in the present situation? Well, to go into a discussion of that would become one of these generalized statements which are being put out almost by the ton daily, and which you can find in one publication after another. And you have enough representatives of your denomination and of others who are constantly putting out books and articles on the role of the church in the inner city, the role of the church in a changing society, the role of the church in this, and the role of the church in that. Suffice to say that you do know, at least your churches know, that their function can no longer be what it has been in the past, simply that of being a public relations agency or an apologia for the establishment through the generations of the past. whether it be in the South in the past of simply telling slaves that the world to be concerned with is a world after life, so to speak, and that the important things are in the hereafter and not here, or whether it be in the North, where you have had for so many years, as you have today, the kind of so-called liberal minister who was all for change and all for getting involved in the action, all for the ends, but not for the means. And since he is not for the means, and since he doesn't know any other means except those that he is questioning and critical of and negative towards, he therefore abstains from action and indulges in a constant carping criticism on the side. This, incidentally, is an acid test that you may be using if you get into the area of action. With those who come at you and saying, we agree with your ends but not with your means, just the simple question, well, all right, what are you doing and how would you do it? If you don't like the way I'm doing it, you tell me a better way and I'll do it. And then comes the silence and the disengagement. This is the reason why it has been almost impossible to get these critics, not almost impossible, it has been impossible to get them in any kind of a face-to-face debate or discussion, or even to meet you. I only met Harold Fye once in my life, and that was on my insistence. There was a one-hour lunch in which I did all the talking. Not that I was doing all the talking, but because it was impossible to get him to say anything. But that is irrelevant. Now, you cannot, or I cannot, just I choose not to stand up here and tell you all the reasons why your church must get with the action, must get with the people. There are other pressures that are all around that are doing it on you. I don't have any question in the world as it is, in which the right things are always done for the wrong reasons, that your whole spirit of ecumenicity and your getting together in unity finds its genesis and its dynamism out of Moscow and Peking. As you look around the world and see what's happening, it really became the kind of situation of the old Franklin statement of either we all hang together now or we most assuredly will hang separately later. But you, like everything else, like all people do in all forms of political life, economic life, or any kind of life, you always have to dress it up in a certain kind of moralistic raiment and try to tailor what would be the right reasons for the right decision after the decision has been reached for entirely different reasons. Your church and all churches are confronted with the pragmatic political issue of whether they are going to survive, whether they are going to be, in your own terms, the phrase that you always find being used, whether you're going to be relevant. In other words, whether you've got any reason to be around. And on this basis, you have to get involved in action, whether you choose to or not. And it's on this one point, and that's all I'm going to say about it, unless it comes up in discussion. But on this point, there are a couple of remarks that I'd like to make here. If you are thinking of action and getting involved, whether it be civil rights or a number of other burning issues, you have to begin to realize that the days of simple protests, that the days of simple demonstrations, and all of those kinds of tactics that we are very familiar with But those days are over with. And actually, their efficacy only came about because of the fact that society had not experienced an action from a particular sector of society. Any kind of an action that it took, any kind, would have been so unexpected that in itself it would have been outside of the experience of the prevailing status quo and would have come as sort of a shock to it. But once it had reached the point of expecting action, then these particular kinds of tactics have lost their efficacy. You want to pull a sit-in on General Motors, you know what will happen to you? They'll give you coffee, they'll give you reading materials, and they'll even give you entertainment, colored TV as well. And you can sit there until hell freezes. But if you can think back as recently as 5 or 6 years ago, a sit-in hit the front pages of the papers. Today, you're lucky if it even gets into the papers, and if it does, it gets in on page 26. Now, what I am suggesting here is that as you begin to move into the field of action, and for many of you, this will be a radical departure and moving into an arena which is very different from what you have been brought up in. I think that you had better start giving some thought to the fact that the conflict that you will be getting into requires a highly sophisticated and a very and it's a very complex situation. But I repeat, a highly sophisticated understanding, insight, and approach to it. I'd like to give you two quick examples. One is that we are now living in a corporate economy. And when you are dealing with a corporate economy, and you're dealing on fundamental issues, of which jobs is a number one, that you have to design, first of all, you have to understand what that kind of an economy is, and you have to understand the areas of vulnerability and how you operate in it. And let me give you a specific case. The issue of fight vis-a-vis Eastman Kodak. Now, once that issue was drawn, if you look at it from a pure tactical strategic point, there wasn't a thing outside of some harassment that fight could have done alone against Kodak. To begin with, Rochester, New York was not Kodak's world. Kodak's world was nationwide and worldwide, its market. You could not even begin to think in terms of the kinds of tactics which you hear so commonly talked about, such as an economic boycott. The control and the monopoly that Kodak has on the photographic market, particularly the negative market, films. You don't get films out of Japan. You get very little out of Germany and very little out of England. And and even the German films, Kodak has a nice big hand in. Just as Kodak practically owns the Distelitz Corporation, which provides I think the base for the 90% of the vitamin drugs in this country. You get into a corporate economy, you start getting into all kinds of ramifications. But if you were trying to get a boycott on films, what you were really doing was saying to the American people, don't take any pictures. And obviously, this was not going to work. So the move came in on a series of levels. It came in on what you have read about on the proxy fight, in which churches were asked, as you may remember, the slogan was, keep your sermons, give us your stock proxies. And there was an interesting example of the contradictions that make up life, that the very materialistic investments of organized religion that one is always so concerned about will be corrupting the spirit of the church, here actually provided the avenue of salvation for the church, where they could really move into action using their material investments for a social change, for a social objective. But when those churches started voting proxy support, the important thing was not just the proxy support. It would have been very difficult, and we were fully aware of it. I think I had it estimated that by the next board meeting over at Flemington, we might have gone with about $128 million worth of proxies, which would have been very little, enough to elect one member to the board or something, but not to decide the issue. But the important thing was that the proxy attack, every time when the Unitarians and National Convention voted their proxies behind us, immediately every congressman, everyone who was running for election, and this, remember, we were on the threshold of an election year, which we are now, immediately began counting up how many Unitarians they had in their congressional district. When the Disciples, when the UEBs, when the Presbyterians in different sectors, the Episcopalians in different sectors, began voting theirs and offering us their proxies, that would immediately cause a political reaction in Washington. And it was this combination, which was being parlayed, as well as other factors without going any further into it, but to give you an idea of what is involved in tactics and bringing a corporation to terms. Now, I suggest that you keep this in mind rather than think along the ideas of a kind of organization, a kind of movement which involves demonstrations and a few other dramatic for the moment operations, and operations which today are highly ineffective. As a matter of fact, they weren't too effective in many areas, even in the past, because they were movements. They were, as I frequently said, the heating up of the climate which crested into a demonstration, and the next day it was gone. There wasn't anything there, such as Selma, where everybody went home right after that. And it is essential that there be an organized base that has the power to not only compel concessions, but compel the opposition to live up to their commitments, to deliver. Because remember that in the political arena, that once you get a concession from the authorities, from the status quo, the establishment, the power structure, call it what you want to, in our organization we simply refer to it as the enemy. Once you get that, if they fail to live up to it, you can't go to court. You have no way of getting delivery except through the same strength that compelled the original concession. Now, that's one point for you to keep in mind. The second point, and this is important for many of you, because many of you are going into areas of society that I don't think you realize at this time. You're either going into those areas or you're deliberately choosing not to go into those areas because you feel that your quotes, your mission, or whatever you want to call it, lies with the underprivileged, etc. Keep in mind what so many people do not think about, that the census is going to show what we already know, that approximately three-quarters of our population is middle class. We are, as far as I know, the first nation in Western civilization that has emerged as a predominantly middle-class nation in which the poor are a distinct minority. I'm saying this to you as an organizer of the poor. I'm saying to you that if you take the entire Negro population, the entire Puerto Rican population, the entire Mexican-American population, all of the Appalachian whites, and whatever other low-income groups we have, and put them together, they will and they do today represent a very distinct minority. I don't know of any other nation in the world in which the poor are a minority at this time. Now, in that kind of a situation, an organized minority must do what all minorities have done, whether you be a small nation or whether you be a small organization, a small anything, you must seek out allies to carry the fight. And where these allies will lie will be, obviously, in that society around us, in that middle-class society. There will have to be invasions and organization of sectors of that white middle-class society, whether you call them liberals or whatever you want to call them, that will then be able to be hooked onto, that will be allies for the low-income organization, the organization of the poor. When you talk about black power, for example, and we'll talk about it a little later, obviously, that kind of a condition, let's assume black power means, well, I've always assumed it to mean, an organization, a mass organization of the ghetto. Once that is done, that period, this is the reason why I have, I make the reference in this month's Harper that black power will be like the blue period in Picasso. It'll pass and has to, because you soon reach a point, once you have organized the ghettos, where you'll have to find your allies. Once we have organized every Negro in Rochester, New York, we will have organized between 35 and 40,000 people out of a general metropolitan population of better than 400,000. So that obviously our potentials are limited unless we have allies. That's why as far back as 2 years ago, we went through the black power phase and were out organizing white liberals, primarily through the Rochester Area Council of Churches. And the organization known as Friends of Fight came into being. In Buffalo, we have been in the ghetto now for about 10 months, and we are now launching an organization among the white liberals of Buffalo, organizing allies which are absolutely indispensable and essential. Now, what I'm saying, let me add one other thing. In the Training Institute, which we will be setting up sometime in the near future, sometime about a part of next year, at least 40% of the student body, which will be accepted, will be trained for organization in white middle-class society, because that job is going to be almost as important as the other. But keep in mind, that the job, when people talk about black power, when they talk about organization of the ghetto, etc., this is absolutely an essential primary step, because unless the ghetto is organized, you do not have the initial basis from which to ally with. You can't get integration unless you have two bodies. You can't have an alliance unless you have two organizations. So that it still remains, from our point of view, from our position, and particularly since most of our experience has been, not all of it, in the low-income groups, to push for this. But the other job is one which will become of increasing importance. What I'm saying to you is that assignments in white middle-class society are going to offer, if you are going along with this, or using your own words, committed. I hate to use that word because it always smacks of a certain dogma, you know, with a certain business of being a little bit kooky, you know, liking a hair shirt and things like that. Or, well, I guess dedicated is worse, isn't it? But if you are going along with this general program, then don't think that the action is all going to be in what you call the inner city. It is going to be just as important to to organize for action in the outer city. And one will not be able to make it in this kind of a middle-class society without the other. So, I've given you two ideas. I was told in college it's very rough for people to hold more than two ideas to begin with. And anyway, I've got a panel here. We're going into the give and take.